Morning, Kendra. Everything is still just fine. I'm glad to see that today.
Yep, I decided this is a good one to have for a little while.
I like it quite a bit. I might even be persuaded. Can you find that television program online or?
Yeah.
And what's the name of the program?
The Good Place.
A Good Place, okay. Morning to everybody else. Glad to see you're all still kicking.
Good morning.
Sorry about that. That's the dangers of working at a glass table. Although I suppose this is my new gavel in case anybody gets out of order. And I'm looking at you, Scott.
The noise could be worse. It could be a child screaming, so it's not that bad.
So, Doug, you guys pushing on the tax increase, huh?
You bet, man.
Good for you.
Vote for the gusto.
You know what? I thought that. I read that. I mean, on the surface, and, of course, knowing what we know about the challenges, that seems like a pretty reasonable request. And an opportunity. Everybody talks about how much they care about water and want to defend water in the West. Well, you might need to pay a little bit for it. So
we have a large discussion, and as you can imagine, we had some philosophical discussions as well, because there was quite a few of the the conservative counties, they didn't want to make sure, they wanted to put in the ballot issue that they didn't want to have this money being able to go into paying for fallowing or paying for by and dry and the rest. And so, so keep it simple so the taxpayers can understand. You have 15 board members, you have a governance process. And so, and the commissioners appoint each of the River District board members. So, I had a hard time convincing my fellow board members to not tie the hands of a future board, because it might be, and it probably isn't, and I'm not in favor of that kind of stuff either. But you just keep it simple, keep it so that the taxpayers can understand, and put something out there that and then trust that your board that will be able to take care of that. So. And it's so menial for the whole thing. I mean, the River District originally started out with 5 mills. We have 0.25 mills now, and we're asking to double that to come up with 0.5 mills. And originally we started out with 5 mills. And you guys should all understand, I mean, this the energy business and the rest on our budget is just being catastrophic. So. Yeah. So.
Well, I guess for someone like me that knows just enough to be dangerous, it sure seems like for our part of the world, that's for a common good and a really important common good. And yeah, I know I'm one of those water users that irrigates, and I'm not looking for anybody to subsidize my operations, but certainly keeping water on the land in our part of the world, it's hard to imagine much higher priorities. So good for you for getting it done.
Yep.
Okay. We are, everybody's present, raring to go. I think the first item on our agenda is our COVID-19 discussion. Items for discussion. Outside of what we're going to be talking about at 11:30. Mark, do you have any recent updates for us?
Commissioners, I'll kind of leave this opportunity if you want to have a little bit more of a detailed dialogue, but I sent you an email yesterday providing a little bit more background information on the investigation that we're doing on space allocation for public health. And one of the things that I wanted to perhaps clarify is that we have an opportunity with both spaces to identify just specific spaces for our public health personnel. So in other words, even though we might have 2,800 square feet available on a made for first floor, we can identify that we only want to use 1,500 square feet of that now for our particular needs. So we've got some flexibility with that. And I maybe misspoke or maybe I got out ahead of my headlights a little bit in talking about human services. That would not be something that we would enter into now, but it would only be a consideration in the future if we felt that need was there. So just wanted to provide that clarification. We want to do a little more due diligence on that. And we think it's important that a couple more people get a chance to look at the two facilities that we've identified. So we've asked Robert from IT to go by to make sure that it's going to be suitable from an IT perspective in terms of what they would maybe need to deploy in there. We're also going to ask Mo and maybe Carrie Littman to go by and take a look, because as both Doug and Beth know, on our recovery call this morning, there's a possibility we may have an opportunity to store some PPE and also accommodate some of their supply needs. So that's an additional maybe bonus to having this additional space. But I think the main point that I wanted to emphasize in my note back to you, commissioners, is we are truly at a level right now of approximately 12 staff members within public health. And even though we have some space right now we're working with, it's very tight, it's very limited, and quite frankly, it's really not going to be a long-term, even a midterm solution. So I think it's important that we think more seriously about this. With that field tour coming up on Monday of next week, and by the way, that would also include our proposed interim director of public health, I would be prepared next week, well, let's call it midweek, to come back to you with a more firm proposal on that space.
Thank you, Mark, for all that due diligence and thinking through what our needs are short-term and long-term. One question I had, I was under the impression that contact tracers would not necessarily need to be issued a laptop, that they could perform their functions off of their own computers as long as they had email access, or was I confused about that?
Tim, your point is well taken. And quite frankly, I think that it would be ideal if they've got a laptop and they've got that resource that they can provide themselves. But I think where that's not been the case, then we've got to be prepared to go ahead and maybe issue that to them so that they can perform their duties to the best of our abilities. Now, getting back to the space allocation piece, there's a in both buildings, there are areas that what I would call is a bullpen area. And the advantage of that is, I think if you've got contact tracers, or you may in the future have health educators, at some point in time, it's maybe going to be beneficial that they properly social distance and they have a chance to go ahead and collectively to be together to talk about some of the mutual projects that they've got going forward. So if we've got a desktop there that somebody could safely utilize and they don't necessarily need a laptop, there's another outlet for those contact tracers. So I probably, Tim, quite frankly, didn't do a good job of answering your question directly, but I think that what we found is that we've got to try and put as much flexibility forward for those positions as possible.
Great, thank you for that.
And so Mark, following up on that, just in terms of the space needs, you're not necessarily identifying a dedicated office space for each of those contact tracers, because I heard you say 12 people, but I guess that they were able to work from home, and we're continuing to encourage people to work from home, I hope, in alignment with the governor's recommendations and guidelines.
We are right now, if we've got the four contract nurses, Beth, yeah. They have been coming in on a regular basis to mm-hmm. the dedicated space that we've got for them. We assume that that would be the protocol going forward. So we've got four spaces identified for them. One or two might be a shared office. There's a total of seven spaces in what would be our number one building that we would select, seven individual office spaces in a very large, generous bullpen area, and a kitchen, IT resources, and supply area. So right now, that would easily accommodate the needs that we've got right now. And the people that we've seen coming in that we would ask to be there on somewhat of an on-site regular basis. The other thing that we're checking on, commissioners, is if we decide that we have the capability to do some testing adjacent to that facility, then we need to be sure that we are allowed to do that under city code, zoning code requirements. So that's another piece that we're investigating right now. We don't want to get the cart ahead of the horse in terms of announcing that we can do testing there if that's not allowed by some type of zoning code. So we're doing that due diligence on that as well. The other piece, Tim, I did want to just bring up to speed the commissioners. And again, we talked about this briefly on the recovery call. We have gotten some names and contact information from the city of Steamboat Springs that have come forward in the last week. We're going to hopefully get maybe a couple more trickling in by tomorrow, Thursday, close of business. But right now, officially, we have five people who have volunteered their services for either testing support or education monitoring compliance. And we are, Mo and Scott and Carrie Littman are working with contacting those people and making sure that we've got some scheduling opportunities, we've got some training opportunities, but the most important thing to convey to you is that we've talked about partnerships, we've talked about collaboration. Really, really pleased to see that the city of Steamboat Springs has stepped forward and volunteered those people to assist us in that effort. And of course, you know, protect our neighbors, it talks about partnerships and collaboration. So it certainly resonates along those lines, but it was really, really encouraging to see that we got that that support coming forward from the city of Steamboat Springs.
So I can give, so Mark, I actually wasn't on the recovery call this morning. Unfortunately, I had some other stuff I had to deal with, but I can give Tim and Doug, I can give you guys an update on, I met with the policy group yesterday and to continue talking about Protect Our Neighbors. And you'll see the notes from that when those come. But in short, we're just working through that document that I created, talking about each of those five things that we're kind of looking for from various entities and still considering that document in draft form. And they're giving me some thoughts and comments on that. And then I started, I worked with Carrie a little bit on determining what the planning activities might be for the planning grant. That's that $50,000 that we can request from the state. And that aligns with that document that I shared with you guys for, you know, the sort of commitments from community partners. And so I have that, I think you guys are included, it went to the recovery team, kind of a skeleton outline of what our planning activities would be and what we would maybe request funding from the state for. So would love any feedback you guys have on that. And I think ideally we would request that funding by the end of this week. They are saying that they're turning those around in a week. My guess is it's kind of a no-brainer. You just tell them what you want to do and they give you the money. I don't think it's a super intensive process, but just want to make sure that there's some agreement on what those planning activities should be. Although this would not typically be in my scope of duties, I'm more than happy to just submit that grant application. I think it's really brief. It's just a short narrative. And I'm fine doing that as long as I have everyone's blessing on what I'm putting in there. And, you know, in short, it's looking at evaluating what our needs are kind of from an infectious disease standpoint and an epidemiological standpoint, and then identifying what the resources are to kind of fill those needs. And there's two pieces of that. I think it's the engagement with the community partners that might be able to provide resources. And then it's also thinking about, there's that additional $150,000 grant from the state, which does require that we match whatever amount we spend there. But it would be identifying any needs that we have that we might request that funding for in terms of building infrastructure to move in to protect our neighbors, and to support and be prepared for any surges in cases that we might see, and kind of have a plan for that. So that's kind of what's in there. But I would love if you guys had a few minutes to look at the actual document so that we make sure everyone's on the same page about where we think we need to head there.
And then thanks for that, Beth. The $50,000 planning grant, how would you envision those dollars being spent in broad, just in very broad terms?
Well, so, you know, I laid out the actual planning activities, which, like I said, essentially includes some analysis from the infectious disease standpoint, some engagement with community partners. Carrie recommended, and I think she's right, really making sure that we have a solid plan around vulnerable populations. So those are the kind of activities. How the dollars get spent, I think honestly, it's just figuring out a split between, we can request those dollars for staff time. So I think it's identifying what staff resources we have available that we could just use that money to support their time. And then identifying where there are places where we might need to bring in a consultant or on a contract basis, someone to kind of do that type of analysis and planning for us. And I honestly see it being really just a split between those two things in the way I'm envisioning it initially, at least.
I'm relieved to hear that that some of those dollars could be devoted to staff time and would not have to exclusively be spent on consultants or outside advisors. So that's great. Thank you.
Right. And I think especially bringing on an epidemiologist, we may find that that person can do a lot of the analysis work that's needed, and we can use a portion of this money to offset their salary and their time.
Sounds like another coding challenge for staff and for accounting.
I know. And I think, you know, I asked Carrie and she said she asked the state, like, can't you just write us a check? Like, why does this money have to be different than the other money, you know? And they just, of course, have said, well, that's not going to be an option. So it is what it is, I guess. Hopefully we don't spend all $50,000 on the staff time needed to do the reporting for the grant.
So I pulled this thing up. I'm not, you know, quite clear. I mean, I'm looking at it right now, and, you know, planning activity 3, 2, and 1, and, you know, 4 and 5, you know, I guess, so there's no dollars allocated to any of that. So when do we do that? And again, you know, this is kind of a little mixed blood here, because this is our money in the first place, should have been our money, that the governor robbed out of the 55-45, that was our money to start with, should have been our money. And then, so now we're going to give it back to us with these little strings attached so that we can figure out how we can do social engineering here. Basically, the situation of so how do we tie in COVID into having more vaccine and doing flu vaccine things?
So under Protect Our Neighbors, there is a requirement that you demonstrate how you're going to increase flu vaccination rate. And I would let Dr. Harrington answer the question about how those two are related. I mean, my understanding is that there's a concern that when it's flu season, that'll just exacerbate the taxing of resources, especially healthcare resources like hospital beds, that kind of thing. But I won't pretend to be an expert on that. But that is a requirement under Protect Our Neighbors to increase flu vaccine uptake. In response to your first question, I'm going to just ignore the part about complaining about the state not giving us our money, because you know I agree with you. There's just nothing.
That's all right. It's just a philosophical discussion.
Yeah, it's fine. Philosophical questions. That's fine. I agree. I wish they had just written us a check. But what I would say is this is the first draft on what I think the planning activities are. I do need some help figuring out how we allocate dollars within the budget for this grant application. I'm not quite sure. And so I did want to start with just what I think the planning activities need to be based on the Protect Our Neighbors framework. But we do need to figure out what the budget for the grant application looks like. And that's where I'm asking for some input from the recovery team. And if you guys have any thoughts, Doug, if you would like to schedule some time, or even we could just use some of our COVID work session time, probably not today, but maybe, you know, tomorrow or Friday, for me to walk through this and us to just talk about it, that would be fine with me too. I mean, I don't mind doing it that way if you guys would like me to do that.
I think that sounds like a good idea. Again, I don't know. And then I was sitting here, are we even going to be eligible for anything after the seven cases yesterday? So it's like, really? So are we just fruitfully putting out this work here so that we know?
Well, here's what I would say, Doug. I'd go back to what we said about Protect Our Neighbors before, which is regardless of when we're actually ready to apply for that phase and move into that phase, the work of building the infrastructure around, you know, the framework is still good. And it's going to help us to keep our disease prevalence lower if we can really build these strong systems. And especially with partnerships from multiple entities. So I think that the Protect Our Neighbors application and framework is really just that. It's a framework for this. And in my mind, I don't necessarily see moving into Protect Our Neighbors as the only goal of doing this work. I think it's strengthening the system we have for supporting public health during this emergency. It was really interesting. I had a phone call with Jill Ryan the other evening, and we were, you know, I had a couple of specific questions for her, but we were just chatting, and she said, you know, Beth, we were talking about testing actually and the turnaround time and the challenges with that. And she said, you know, our framework for responding to public health emergencies and outbreaks is reliant on mutual aid. You know, just like with a wildfire, right? You bring in resources, you borrow from people, you do all these things, and they don't have the opportunity to do that in this situation because everybody's being impacted. And I just thought that was interesting because I hadn't thought about it. But I think this is just an example of trying to leverage every resource we have as a community to address this rather than everything being the responsibility of the county, which I think we're getting to a point where, you know, we've pretty much exhausted the resources the county is able to provide. And so the only way we're going to build a stronger system is just by bringing in more partners. And that's what I see this exercise as doing for us.
So, yeah, you're right. We've exhausted and expanded. So, you know, we've actually grown and we're growing and we're learning day by day. So, but anyhow, so no, I struggle sometimes with the activity and then what that actually means and what's the boots on the ground? Where's the meat on the bone and where does that come back to us and how do we actually do those things? So yeah, I think a conversation from us. yeah. I don't want to be left behind on this and it all sounds great, but what does that actually mean? And that's what we need to get to. So I agree.
Well, I said I would take the lead on this. I never said I would do the whole thing. So I am more than happy to talk through it. And it really is just a first draft. And I sometimes you just need some place to get the conversation started. But my goal would be that we could submit that grant by the end of the week so that we can make sure to get that funding in hand going on these activities.
So is it a requirement of the grant application that you provide a budget?
Yeah, but I need to look at the requirements a little more closely. I think it's pretty, I mean, you guys know I have some background in grant administration, so I'm fine with doing this. I think it's pretty big picture. You know, it's like salaries, X number of dollars, you know, contracts, X number of dollars. So,
right. Yeah. And presumably they recognize that we'll need flexibility moving forward as situations and challenges and needs change. I mean,
that's the part I do need to look at the documentation and just make sure I understand what their rules are in terms of moving dollars between line items and some of that kind of stuff, because that will determine how tight our budget needs to be, how flexible their rules are about that.
Yeah, and it seems to me that we're talking about a planning grant, not an actual execution grant. Mm-hmm. So planning in of itself is going to be a little bit vague. Kind of a random question, but that might pertain to this effort, is in our contact tracing, is there a software platform that's available for our contact tracers? Or are we just doing this longhand or in Excel spreadsheets? Do you have any idea how that is being done?
I don't know the answer.
Well, we can ask Carrie and Dr. Harrington. I'm just curious about that. Seems to me that somebody would have developed something by now. I can't believe I hear myself saying that we should buy more software or something, but it might make sense in this case. Anything else before we move on to our regularly scheduled public health session? We're getting close enough. I think we could kick that off unless there's something else we need to talk about.
I don't have anything else. I would just mention, because you guys might be interested, I got a phone call from Hillary Cooper yesterday. Because they are trying to figure out how to get epidemiology in place. They're interested in setting up a community test site and they wanted to know a little bit about ours. But it sounds like Hillary has really been leading the charge, not surprisingly, but that she's been really hands-on in figuring out all this stuff for them. Do you guys even know their other two commissioners? I couldn't say I even know their names.
Yeah, there's Lance, who's got elected in 2018.
Okay.
Younger guy, but seems real competent. And then, oh gosh, I can't remember her name. She's been there for a while. I'll think of it in a second. Yeah, I know their other commissioners.
Okay. I just realized when I was talking to her, I was like, Hillary, I don't think I've even ever heard of your other two commissioners.
Well, you know, Hillary is a force of nature all on her own. So, I could see where she'd be taking the lead. Let's put it that way. You know, these young women are just hard to deal with sometimes. That's just the way it is.
Hey, you. Watch it. Wait till you meet us.
Okay, I think we're close enough to 11:30. I don't see where Dr. Harrington has joined us quite yet, but I suppose that we could ask Carrie to get the ball rolling here. Let's get started, and hopefully Dr. Harrington will join us shortly.
He's coming. I think he's just with some patients right now. So he will be here. So I will go ahead and just give you an update. A few things I wanted to touch on is the current status with testing and contact tracing. We have administered in public health 3,715 tests total since the beginning of March. And so just to kind of walk through that process on what that means and what that looks like. So there's the scheduling piece of getting folks into the community testing site, and then the actual administration. Obviously, we all are familiar with the swabbing process. Once that's done, then there are all the calls for the on the back end to notify residents of their test results, and then also the administration of the quarantine and isolation orders, depending on what the results look like. And then the alert of the contact tracing team if there are some positive results. And I actually have some good news on the testing from the state. I was on a call yesterday afternoon and they said that they have been able to deploy that third shift. And so they are able to increase their turnaround time from the, I mean, we were 10, 12 days, it was a long time on our results, and they should be able to deliver results within 3 to 5 days and get back on track with that, which isn't ideal. You know, we've kind of ebbed and flowed in the amount of time that's taken to get test results. And at the high point, it was actually 24 to 48 hours we were getting test results back, which was great. But at least the pendulum is moving from the 10, 12 days back down to 3 to 5. So that's good news. We haven't been the recipient of that quick turnaround, faster turnaround time just yet. But hopefully with the ones that we're doing today at the community testing site and some of the other vulnerable populations testing, we'll be able to get those back faster. So that's good news on the CDPHE side of things. And then as far as from the contact tracers, I know there's been a lot of interest in contact tracing and what's been going on. And so we've had 14 volunteers that have been doing the contact tracing since several months ago. And those people, there's four contact tracers that have been converted over from volunteer paid staff. And in addition to that, there are five other ones, bless you. There are five other ones that are just waiting to have their background checks done. And so I think that should be, I don't quite have an update yet from HR, but I think that should be done pretty shortly and have them on the payroll as contact tracers. And David Wallace, who's the person from the CDC, is still leading the charge on that. We also have another person named Tracy Melton, who is stepping up into more of a scheduling and lead role with the contact tracers. So the contact tracing is I think it's gonna be a positive for the community to have those volunteers converted over to paid employees just for consistency's sake. And it sounds like that's in the process of being finalized. In addition, we had a call on Monday with all the clinics, the medical clinics in the community, or not all, but the majority of the medical clinics called in. And we just wanted to make sure that they have what they need as far as testing information. So how to test, how to obtain supplies, any questions about PPE, any concerns that they had from the medical clinic provider side. And so we reviewed the process and what kind of the successes that we've had and some of the challenges that we've had. And I feel like that medical provider part will be really important moving forward to have the providers testing their patients as they see appropriate. So that I think that call went well. And then in addition, vulnerable populations. So we had our vulnerable populations task force on Monday and talked with all the Horizons, Casey's Pond, all of the, we've now added a few other vulnerable populations to that task force. And so that was a good meeting. We have recommended really beefing up the PPE in case of an outbreak, in case of an emergency from the vulnerable population side. And so Dr. Harrington had previously made some recommendations about the vulnerable populations needing to have some additional supplies on hand. And they've been, the vulnerable populations groups we talked to have been stocking up on those. And so we're having that coming into fruition is really a best practice, and they're working hard on their end. So they've been connected with Carrie Littman in order to facilitate that PPE from the Rock County side moving forward. She's gonna help coordinate the PPE and the vulnerable population. She did attend the call on Monday and was able to participate, and so is connected with that group now. And just another side note is, flu, as we approach the fall and flu and COVID kind of start intermingling, there was some discussion at the CDPHE immunizations call about doing flu clinics as part of community testing site clinics. And so I think that would be something that may be of value moving forward if that's an option in the fall to pair some flu vaccinations with the COVID testing. I think that's about it as far as the updates that we have. I know Dr. Harrington has prepared some data discussion as well.
Hello, everybody. We'll go through the data day and I'll comment on some of the themes that we've seen recently. I want to point out that when we talk about data in this setting and epidemiologically, we're usually referring to the date that the test was collected. And the public just needs to be aware that when we report cases, we're reporting them as results roll in. So that date of when we get a result is not always the same as when, it varies from when the test was actually collected. So sometimes there can be a little bit of a difference there. During the past 2 weeks, and I define a week as Monday through Sunday. So during the preceding 2 weeks, we had 14 cases attributed to Rauch County. Plus we had two other cases that were non-residents who had recently arrived here to spend some time over the summer and they tested positive, but they're not part of that 14 that's reflected. And I'll first show you the histogram here that Emmy has been nice enough to work with me on. There's one that dates back basically to the middle of June, which is when our cases really started occurring. And then the lower histogram just shows where we are here in July. Our case counts are small enough that we've got to be careful on interpreting trends because, you know, you can have a jump from one to two cases and that's going to be 100% difference, but yet absolute terms, it's just one case. But we did have five tests that came back positive that were collected on July 15th. Go ahead, Emmy, and switch over to our Google dashboard, if you would, please. Scroll down to the daily positive tests as a percentage of daily test. So little quiz here, top ahead. Anybody want to guess why our spike is higher on July 12th? Well, I'll give you the answer. That's a Sunday. Not many tests being done on a Sunday, and they had one positive test, and I think that was from an ER patient. So our numbers are small enough that in our, you know, there's variation in the amount of testing that we do. We have to factor that in a bit when we see some of these variations. Overall, our test positivity rate has continued to remain low. If we discount that one spike, we're still in the kind of the 1 to 3 range. You can scroll across there, I mean, if you want. Yep, like that. So that's the highest there, 5.56 on that particular day. We believe that if our test positivity rate is below 10%, that means that we're testing enough, and it also implies that the prevalence in the community is at a, I want to be careful saying tolerable level, but our danger mark is 10%. And then looking below there, go ahead.
Sorry, can I just ask you about that 10%? I've heard other people use 5% as a benchmark. Will you just talk about that?
Well, and I've seen some people use 15% as well. I've chosen to use 10% as what I feel has been the most typically used one. And that has been discussed, I think, recently more commonly. I think some communities, from what I've seen, have set a tighter benchmark of 5% just as their kind of warning bell. We certainly could. I believe that the convention is 10%. I think that's a decision. If we wanted to have that early warning bell, we certainly could set a lower percentage rate. I think if we had consistent, typically run in this 1, 2%, 3% range. I think if we consistently saw percentages above 5%, then I would pay attention to that and probably consider whether there's a response to have. But we vary in the amount of tests that we do from day to day. And that does affect our test percentage rate a little bit. So it really is this rolling average that can be more helpful just because that's what that 3-day average up above too shows. You can see down below the 14 average number of tests administered. It is important that we administer tests. We have to remember that our most recent days, our data collection is not always complete. We're still waiting for information from some various clinics on how many tests they conducted. But you can see there, like on the 18th and so forth. And we've stayed in that 20 some range for each of these days. And then our unicast data down below hasn't really changed. We still remain not as socially distanced as we were, say, back in May. This we can comment on at last, the Harvard Global Health Institute's COVID risk levels. And so on their map in particular, they're looking at the rate of daily new cases per 100,000 population. And that's a rolling average over the previous 7 days. Colorado is inching up. Last week, they rated us at 7.6, and now we're up to 8.2. And that's just consistent with the state data that shows rising cases. And then Emmy can click on the Route County one there. And we're actually lower than we were last week. I will highlight that this data is from, they're using data that was up to date as of the end of last week. That's where you get that 87 confirmed cases. We technically are at 95 because of test results that have come in this week. But I would still say that those rates for us and for Colorado are certainly do not qualify in any kind of hotspot level like we see some of the other states that are well above that. Before I move on to some other comments about our particular cases, any comments on what we've shown you so far or questions?
Just a quick question, Dr. Harrington. Test results that we saw yesterday, we could assume are somewhere in that 10 to 12 day old time frame.
So we got some tests back yesterday. So yesterday was the 21st, I think, right? And we got test results back that have been collected on July 15th. So that was a 6 day lag.
Okay.
Thank you. And those were through the state lab. I have in the past week consistently seen tests I've ordered through the hospital system returning in under 48 hours sometimes, and certainly within 72 hours. So the UC Health System right now does appear to consistently be a quicker turnaround time than either the state lab, LabCorp, or Quest. And again, that's partly related to the testing materials are being used more or being diverted more to other hotspot states. And so the labs down the Front Range are in a pinch right now to have both the reagents and the chemical platforms and maybe a little bit of labor issues too in terms of rising number of tests that are being submitted.
Given that those time frames that you just described, would it be fair to conclude that there's no direct correlation between these most recent positive test results and the July 4th weekend?
I would look at that by the date of the test being collected, and we would tease it further by looking at onset of symptoms. But I've been looking at that similarly, wondering, you know, are we gonna see a big jump from July 4th? We're kind of at that range where the 4th, now we're at the 22nd. We're really at that point where we should be getting a flavor of that. I don't know that we can say absolutely yes or no. Looking at the previous 2 weeks, we had 14 cases attributed to Route County. Plus, we had two that were out-of-state residents but were tested positive when they came here after traveling here. When I look at the last couple weeks of the previous 2 weeks to that, so going back the third and fourth week before that, those 2 weeks, we also had 14 cases. So you might say that we've stayed somewhat stable amount of cases that we've collected. I feared that we would be seeing a higher rise in cases by now. So if my fear was at all rational, then we might be able to say that, yes, we've done better than expected after the July 4th weekend. Yeah, I think we've all kind of been looking at that, wondering when do we see that lag out, right? So we expect people are going to get symptoms about a week out on average. So we would have seen that, in the past week. On average, folks are going to start presenting into hospitals a couple weeks out, and then they get critical about 3 weeks out. So we're definitely in that time frame we would have expected to see that. So, if we stay at this level, maybe that implies that our efforts in our town continue to be effective in reducing risk.
Go ahead, Doug.
That's fine. I just quick comment. It was odd or different, the demography of those patients and the rest. And, I've commented earlier, when I was that age, I was bulletproof as well. So just hopefully we figured that out.
Well, let's talk about that for a moment. So of our cases in the past week, last Monday through Sunday, looking at seven cases, two of those were with close contacts. That's how we identified them. The other five people, though, they didn't have symptoms, and there was no known exposure to a positive case. So those five cases would represent what we would call community spread. And while those numbers are low, they are above what I had seen previously. I would suggest that if we see more and more of our cases that fall into this unknown contact area, then we're seeing more community spread, which implies more prevalence in our community. If we look at the age range, and we've published those ages, but if I look at the 14 cases that we had in the previous 2 weeks, two of them, only two were above age 50. The other 12 were all under age 50. We had one person in their 40s. So 11 of our 14 cases involved people in their 30s, 20s, or teenage years. And that's what I had looked at previous weeks. That's what we're seeing statewide. That's what we're seeing nationally. Now, on one hand, maybe that's a good news story because it might imply that the older people are being, as appropriately they should be, are being more cautious in their activities and practicing, you know, the commitments to containing the virus. But it probably does play to the theme that we've seen, that yes, there's different activities being done by people of different ages. I would also add one caveat in that some of these cases that we pick up are part of screening protocols. So for example, we have certain businesses in town that have us periodically screening their employees. And that's where we have found a few of these cases. Certainly we're more likely to see 20 something year olds working at businesses in town than we are 80 year olds. So that's just one caveat there. But I would still say that this fits the national and the state trends, that there appears to be more spread in our younger populations than our older populations.
I have sort of a follow-up on that, and then I had a question about the dashboard that I'll ask. The governor said the same thing, right? That we're seeing all these cases in younger people. I'm actually really, I'm glad to hear that some of these cases were caught through our screening efforts at businesses. I think that's actually, should think of that as a win. You know, that's really great news because that's potentially preventing additional cases, especially when these are people who are interacting with the public in their job. So kudos to you guys for having that program in place. And I think to me, that demonstrates the value of that program. I was wondering, I'm sure this is being worked on both at the state and national level, but I like to think that we can just be better than everybody else. And I'm wondering what kind of education efforts might be valuable in terms of trying to curtail some of this spread among younger folks. That seems like the best avenue is education efforts. It's well in the realm of public health, you know, in terms of prevention and education. And so I guess curious whether that's being pursued or whether you all have any thoughts about the value of pursuing educational efforts targeted at those populations.
Yeah, that would be a good nut to crack, I think. For example, on this public forum here, I doubt we have maybe anybody in their 20s listening. You know, so how are we getting our message out to those people? I know Robin and Cheryl and others can chime in on those ideas of where is that target audience and what modes of communication best reach them. But it does seem like that would be an appropriate effort right now, given the consistent theme that we want to help those population segments best practice disease mitigation and understand the risks that they have, but also the risks they have of giving it to others. And I don't know, I could pause here to see if Cheryl or Robin have any comments to make.
Sure, I'll just add just what we know about 20-somethings and teenagers is that, they follow, they're not on Facebook. Facebook is for old people. We started an Instagram site to provide that information, but that, I don't think they're gonna tend to necessarily follow Route County. So in the past, having looked at other campaigns that are successful with teenagers and 20-somethings, it's usually that they follow somebody famous. So what we may want to think about is, you know, it may not be famous on a national level, but if we can figure out maybe some, whether it's some athletes or others in the community that kids follow, whether it's skiers, snowboarders, you know, baseball players, you know, I'm not sure. But usually the best way to reach that age group is messengers that they look up to that are not necessarily government entities.
Why don't you consider us local celebrities, Robin? Have you heard any of Dr. Harrington's jokes?
Oh.
I'm just joking. But thank you, Robin. I appreciate that. And I know you have some experience with this kind of thing. So it's helpful to think about how we can do that. And it seems like something that would be a worthwhile effort, I guess, in my opinion, to do some targeted work around those kind of education, a campaign targeted at younger folks, personally.
We just dress up Scott Cowman as the Grim Reaper and have him go around from bar to bar at night.
Well, they're all closing at 10 now, Tim. So you'll have, but that's good because then it's not before Scott's bedtime. And head out there.
Yeah, so
at 9 o'clock.
We can do some more research, and we've talked about doing a public survey. So perhaps, and I don't know if 20-year-olds are going to participate in a public survey, but perhaps for people that we do know that are in their age range, I have an 18-year-old, so I can also do some research with his cohort, just trying to figure out, you know, who do they listen to. And maybe we can recruit some messengers to help with that, because just coming from the county is not going to be helpful. And I'm already getting some texts from people that have kids their age that they can help with that as well. So we'll explore that.
Thanks. Can I ask Dr. Harrington, were you going to add a follow-up? I can.
No, leave. Why don't you go ahead and ask Commissioner Milton? I've got a couple of points I want to make, but I'll save those to your comments.
Yeah, Emmy, would you show the dashboard again? There was something that was a little confusing to me, and I'd like some clarification. So at the very top, this box in red, that number just doesn't match any other numbers I've seen. So I guess I'm just curious what data is being presented there.
And I'm sorry, I meant to ask Emmy about that. I had to ask her about a couple other things too. I'm going to put Emmy on the spot a little bit. Emmy, can you explain that box?
We can look at the data directly and see what's going on there.
I'm sorry, Emmy, I meant to ask you about that before we put this out. I forgot.
So this is calculating the last 14 day accumulation, and then putting that against the per 100,000 population is what that's doing.
Yeah, so if we have 14 cases and our county population is roughly 25,000,
so that doesn't seem quite right. There are some in the last 14 days, according to the data I've been given, is 13 days, and then you plug that into the formula and it gives you 50.
Yeah, that number makes perfect sense to me. That looks just about right.
But it doesn't match any, I mean, on the Harvard map, you know, Dr. Harrington, that you showed us, that number was like 3 per 100,000.
Well, that's daily new cases rolling in.
Right, but why would that number be so much higher? I don't know. We don't have to necessarily get into the weeds on it, but that doesn't quite.
Let me work with Emmy and Michelle on that.
I mean, it comes up to roughly 13 cases over a 2-week period.
Yeah. Well,
with our population base, and that sounds about like where we're at.
Yeah, it's a different period of time, and it's total cases during that 2-week period. I think that stems from, you know, quite some time ago, we based what we were looking at all on 2-week periods. Lately, though, some of the things we're referring to are more on 1-week rolling averages. So this is not necessarily discrepant from the other number where we say we have 1.8 cases per day per 100,000 people or whatever. because that's a per day thing.
Fox, I made as a metric for, it's one of the metrics for protect our neighbors. Need to look into that more, but for protect our neighbors, this is going to be a required metric.
Yeah, I guess I thought though that we were in that, in the middle category, not in the high category.
Of this one, this box is the state CDPHE's low, medium, high spread. This has three categories, and with the yellow, we're right in the middle. The protect our neighbor metric was either good or bad. It was only two categories, and I don't remember where the cutoff was, somewhere in the 20s. And so that's why it's red.
But that, that red box is simply a mathematical result. If you've had 13 cases in the last 14 days, that translates into that 50.6
per
100,000 people. It's pretty straightforward math, isn't it, Emmy?
Yeah, yep.
That makes sense. It just, I guess, I don't know, that 50 number just seems like a lot higher number than I've seen anywhere else. But I understand what you're saying, Tim. It does match. So I don't know. Okay, that's, I think that answers the question I had.
I'll send an email. Let me look back at that, make sure I understand what that number means exactly, and why we have it as a red box.
And the state likes to use this per 100,000 people,
right,
as a comparison, so we can easily compare ourselves to Denver County, for instance. It levels the playing field.
Right. Some themes. So on our cases in the past couple of weeks, we in the last week, in fact, I think we had four cases of people who didn't have any symptoms, no known contact, but they were traveling somewhere else. I presume maybe to visit family member, somebody, and they decided to get tested before they went on their trip. And then they came back positive. I actually thought that was a noble effort on those. That's a noble idea to screen yourself before you're going to go on a trip. So I would hold that up as an example of one of many things people can do to try to be safe for others. So the themes that I would highlight that we've kind of talked about is, it seems to me, and again, we talk about small numbers, but in the last couple of weeks, the big majority of our patients have been asymptomatic. There are some who develop symptoms after being tested, but on balance, the majority of our patients have been asymptomatic. Then we could interpret, as I said, the fact that many of these positive tests did not have symptoms, that they would represent communities, or I'm sorry, not that they didn't have symptoms, but we didn't know where they contacted the disease, that they would represent community spread rather than, you know, a close contact with somebody or travel. I talked about the idea of screening before you travel, especially if you're gonna go visit vulnerable family members. We talked about the age range, which is consistent with what the state and national level are reporting, and that it's at least our positive tests are tending to be in younger age ranges. And I think those are my themes today. So on balance, I can't say that we have rising cases in our community. There might be if you think that two extra cases is a trend, and so be it. Well, we're clearly not in decline. And we certainly see that the state numbers are creeping up, and the projections still look for significantly higher numbers as we get into August. That concludes my comments.
I think there was just one other thing I was going to say, and I'm just curious if you would agree. I've heard Tim say this, so I'm going to assume a lot of us had the same reaction to, holy cow, seven cases, new cases in one day, and that that were reported yesterday. But I guess I took a deep breath and thought about it and realized, you know, one day is not a trend. You know, we got a lot of positive cases back in the same day, but unless we see that over multiple days, it's nothing to be alarmed about, I would think, would be the answer. But I guess I would just be curious for your take on that.
Right. We're stuck a little bit to the vagaries of when testing is done. And I mean, if you look back on those other charts too, we didn't do hardly any testing over the July 4th weekend, either Friday, Saturday, Sunday, or any of that. And we're a small enough community that we notice those blips quite a bit. And we tend to get a data dump on Mondays because the state catches up with their work on the weekends. And Carrie might comment on that too. But I would really caution ourselves to comment about the number of test results that we receive on a given day. I think it's more relevant to talk about, okay, we had this many positive tests collected last week or whatever. And that was kind of my original comment too, just trying to highlight the difference between we understandably report the results when you get them in. That's not the same as the dates when they were obtained.
And that's why we have a 14-day rolling average that we look at. So.
Exactly that too, yep.
All right, any more questions for Carrie or Dr. Virgin?
I just pulled, back to the point with Emmy. I guess I'm wondering, we might want to just think about how we're presenting that data, because having it come up in red maybe is a little misleading, because it's really indicating whether we're meeting the metrics for protect our neighbor or not. And I think maybe we should just think about that, because red just makes it seem like we're at this really problematic stage, but all it's really indicating is we're not ready to go in to protect our neighbors yet. So maybe it's just the color that's to be thought about. And I'm looking at the metrics, and it's 25 or fewer new cases per 100,000 people in the past 2 weeks, excluding cases among residents of congregate facilities experiencing outbreaks, which luckily we don't have one anymore. But I also am curious, because for a county that has a population of less than 30,000, it's supposed to be no more than 7 cases in a 2 week period. So I don't know. Anyway, I don't think we have to get into the weeds of that, but maybe just for your consideration, is a red green really the right thing, considering that what it's actually showing is whether we're ready to move in to protect our neighbors or not. And just because we're not doesn't mean we're in a red zone per se.
And I'll own this. This is on me. Emmy gets the data that we send her, and she uses the metrics we've kind of given her to set up. I just have forgotten to deal with this for a couple weeks. I've noticed that red box and kept thinking, I gotta dig on that. And then I forgot. So that's on me. So I'll.
Were you thinking Bronco orange or what?
Cornhusker red, being a native Nebraskan.
Come on, Harrington, why can't you do everything? It's all right. Those are just my armchair epidemiologist comments. I totally understand. But it is a little alarming to see it in red. So maybe it's not so much the data, it's just the way we're presenting it.
Yep. We'll work it.
All right. Now that we've had a nice color discussion, maybe it's time to move on to the next thing on our agenda, which is...
Well, I had another question, Mr. Chair, if I could. So, so since we had the 7 cases identified yesterday and the rest, so how are we doing on quarantine with those, and especially with that younger generation and the rest? And so I'm just asking how all that's working.
I'll let Carrie comment on that first.
Yeah, I can speak to that. Fortunately, if these individuals were identified as close contacts, we already had recommended that they quarantine. And so that's a positive. And then obviously if they're symptomatic, we already recommended that they quarantine. And so I think that those are both in our favor of, yes, we have the delays from the labs, but it doesn't change our process as far as our recommendations, that it really is best just to bunker down and stay home while we're waiting for those tests. And then as far as compliance, I can say that we have not had an issue with any of our cases of known that they have not adhered to their isolation orders or quarantine orders.
Yes, I'll leave those details alone. We occasionally are challenged with individuals in certain situations and work those, but on the majority, our contact, the people respond and are cooperative with that.
Yeah, we have had some conversations with some folks that were tempted to not adhere, but they have become very compliant after the conversations. So that's good.
No, that's not a surprise. Anywhere you go around the country, you're going to find that there'll be some people who maybe don't understand or don't agree. But on balance, we've got good compliance with our isolation and quarantine recommendations from people.
Yeah, I would imagine it's tough. I mean, if it's the work environment, or whether it's the, just go out and play environment. So I imagine it's really tough. So, thank you.
And again, the delay in test results. So if we have a business who's screening employees and we don't get a test result back, I mean, because when we're screening those employees, we don't have them identified as needing to be in quarantine or anything. They're just doing routine surveillance screening. Then we get a test result back 6-7 days later and it's positive. That's a lot of missed time to actually intervene. In fact, sometimes we get these results back sometimes and we give people an isolation order for a couple of days because they're already through most of their isolation period, even though they weren't isolated.
Well, and I do want to reiterate that there have been a lot of responsible young people that have done a great job and really care about their families, care about their grandparents, don't want to hurt anyone. And so I think, yes, there's some trends across the nation, but we've also had some really outstanding behavior by young people. So I just want to give them a shout out too for the people that have, taken a lot of responsibility and done the right thing because they have.
Well, I think also reiterating what one of you said, I think it was Dr. Harrington said about, it's tempting to say, oh, this is happening because they're out partying and whatever else, because we all think about what happened when we were in our 20s. And like, I'm still in my 30s, right? This is not, right? So, but also these are the people who are working in jobs where they're interacting with the public. These are the people who do not have the opportunity to work at home and be isolated. So there's more than one reason that these things are happening. You know, they're the ones waiting tables. They're the ones cooking food. They're the ones working in the grocery store. And so we have to be fair about, not just saying, oh, it's all their fault for making bad choices. I think that's probably far from the truth.
No, it goes back to the being able to, help the businesses in these and in this frontline environment that we help with the getting testing on them for sure, absolutely. So,
totally. Well, I'm just eyeballing the data here, but it's probably correct that many of our business surveillance screening positive tests that we get are in that age range, and that's exactly to your point, Mr. Melton, is that these are who are the employees are in these businesses. They tend to be in their 20s and 30s.
I'm sorry, Tim, I'm going to throw one more in here.
I've got one more myself, so go
sounds
ahead.
Sounds good. Right before you all were here, we were having some conversation about flu vaccines and some questions. Could you help us understand kind of the relationship, what we're expecting in flu season and what the role of flu vaccines might be in helping with COVID specifically?
Yeah, I think this is going to be a important extra piece of our responsibilities this next month is to get the message out and really ramp up the use of the flu vaccination. I'm sure Carrie has been involved in some of the state meetings we've been talking about. I'll let her comment too. The challenges are multifold when we're dealing with this COVID. When we get in cold and flu season, anybody with a sniffle or a cough or a fever now all of a sudden gets thrown into the risk for having COVID. The fewer the people that we have with coughs, sniffles, and fevers, the better off it's going to be for us trying to wade through schools, businesses, and so forth to continue staffing themselves. Also, there is concern of co-infection and having infection from both influenza and COVID-19. But the other big thing is worries that, a theme with COVID has been we're going to overwhelm our hospitals. We're going to overwhelm our ICUs. Some of those beds in each winter are taken up with influenza patients. So this plays into that whole capacity picture. We decrease our capacity for COVID patients by having influenza patients requiring care in the hospitals. That even though it's influenza, that affects our COVID response and capabilities. Carrie, you want to chime in?
Yeah, I would just add one other thing. So the state has their wildly important goals, their WIGs. And so one of the things that they are doing is for adults 65 and over, one of the goals for this upcoming flu season is to increase their flu vaccination rates amongst that older population from 70.4 to 78%. And so it's been identified, especially with that 65 and older at risk age group, that we as a state really need to move the needle on those flu vaccinations too.
Carrie, I had a random question right before you came on. Do our contact tracers have any kind of a software platform that they work off of for tracking, or is it just Excel spreadsheets and longhand?
Longhand. So we have an investigation form that we use, a pen and paper investigation form that we use that asks a series of questions. So it's standardized throughout all the contact tracing. And then that is uploaded into the CDERS database, the database that we use. So the index case, whomever the index case is, then we upload those investigation forms into the index case. But as far as a software program, no. I have heard from CDPHE that they are vetting some contact tracing solutions to be rolled out. And I think they're down to the final two products. And so I would anticipate that that's something that we in public health could mobilize once that's available, because it would be really nice just for standardization purposes. But right now we're just using our investigation forms.
Presumably that would be hosted at the state level and would not represent an additional IT challenge for us?
I don't think so. It hasn't sounded like it. It has sounded like it would be one of those systems like the CDERS database that we access in some of the other data, you know, REDCap, some of those systems that are at the state level. So I think that would be, and that would be, it would really be advantageous for us to be able to access that.
Okay, thank you. Mm-hmm. All right, I'm going to try again here, guys.
One quick question for Carrie again. So 70.4% vaccination rate to 78. That doesn't seem like much. And so I can understand if we were down at 30 or something like that and whatever. But, man, that's kind of pushing the needle like with an ant or whatever. So I'm just wondering here.
That's the state goal. But just to give you some context, as far as MMR for the measles, mumps, rubella, wildly important goal, the goal is to increase it from, they want a 91% to a 92% increase. So that one is only 1%. So it actually is a big jump across the state to go from the 70.4 to 78%. I think obviously locally it would be great if we could do, you know, knock it out of the park on that. But as far as incrementally, for some of those goals, they're only 1% increments.
Do we have local numbers? Do we know what our typical vaccination flu vaccine rate is locally?
I don't have that. I don't know if I have access to that. Do you, Dr. Harrington?
No, we have flu vaccination rates, but I'm not aware of, children's vaccination rates, mm-hmm. but I'm not aware of overall population flu vaccination rates. The one thing too that I'm starting to recommend, and I think this is consistent with what the state and feds are doing, is they're recommending people get their flu vaccine even earlier this year. You know, we already have COVID here. And so rather than waiting until, I don't know, October or November, it's probably wise for everybody to get the flu vaccine this year as soon as it comes out.
So, and again, thank you both, Carrie and Dr. Harrington. I guess I haven't been a flu shot believer. In fact, I got one about 5 years ago and then didn't do well with it. So, but anyhow, I'm willing to do that. So I guess in our communication effort with Robin, I guess we need to probably start selling the fact of why that's a beneficial thing and for our COVID recovery as well, so that we're not inundating our medical system, as Dr. Harrington said too. So I think we're changing, morphing our communication format here some, but
Well, Commissioner Monger, I'm visualizing you and me with our shirt sleeves rolled up in a picture in the newspaper getting a flu shot.
I just actually heard from one of our beloved nurses that's on the call, and she said that she can actually pull that data, the flu data, so we actually can get that. So we can send that out.
All right, I'm being really patient here. Any more questions before we move on to the next item on our agenda? Ah, that's great. Let's go ahead and talk about amending our public health order and mitigation plans. Eric, are you here, or Linnea, someone from legal to talk to us about this? I see
you. I'm here.
Good.
Hang on 1 second. Stand by 1 second, please. Sorry.
No problem. Take your time.
Should there be an announcer's voice? Stand by for the county attorney.
But yeah, don't take too long, Eric. Otherwise, my fellow commissioners will start firing off more questions.
No, good. I was asked to be in attendance for this by Scott. This is a Scott's presentation.
Oh. I think we're talking about the public health order, aren't we, Tim?
Yeah, we're talking about the public enforcement. Yeah, not Scott's presentation, Eric. This is just, we know that our public health order number 3.
Oh, I'm with you.
Is expiring at the end of the month, and no later than next Wednesday, we should be making a decision as to whether or not to extend that public health order, and if so, whether or not to make any changes to it.
Right. I apologize. I'm working remotely, and my screen is broken up. I can't even read the agenda, quite frankly. But I'm still gonna pass on to somebody else, Linnea, if you don't mind addressing this. She prepared the communication form. Thank you.
Well, other than what's already been said, that this was placed on the agenda so that the discussion can begin. So if there's something more than changing the expiration date, that our office can be working on those changes. I didn't have anything else to add. It's a discussion item only, and obviously the commissioners are familiar with our public health order number 3. Our office would just like some direction on where to go. It's then also, I've already placed it on the agenda for next week as an action item if we need that.
Maybe it would be helpful, Linnea, if you could describe what is in our public health order number 3 that would be different than the governor's safer at home order and any other orders that may be out there from the state level?
Well, as we stand today, the most significant difference is the fact that it requires a mitigation plan or protocol from every business. It has specific areas that should be covered in those mitigation plans, although we don't dictate what should be in those plans. That is up to the business itself. We simply require that they have those, post those, and make them available to their employees. It also has a requirement that customers and employees use a face covering. However, as it currently stands today, the state also has that order. There is a slight difference in that ours does not have an age limit on the face covering, and the state's order is no one under 10 has to wear a face covering. I've referred to this as kind of the business public health order. as it primarily applies to our businesses in our county.
So that's the practical reason that we would that we may want to extend this, was to keep those business mitigation protocols in place.
And or to address any potential situation down the road when the state's face mask order expires. And as stated, our public health order is in effect through the end of the month, the 31st. Without action, it would simply expire.
And so we have had some conversation about whether it makes sense to extend this public health order in 30-day increments, or whether there might be some benefit in extending it for a longer period of time so that we're not having to come back and revisit this every 30 days. So
the last go around, we actually extended it for a bit longer. It was on June 17th, the last extension of this order. And
yeah, we did that for clarity's sake, to try to have it just end at the end of a month so that people weren't worried about the middle of the month.
I think it was also just to not have to do it every 2 weeks, which is what we end up with when it's on a monthly basis.
So I personally would advocate for a 60-day extension in this particular case. It's hard for me to envision the situation changing to the extent that in 30 days from now that the situation would be so different that we would not consider extending it. And of course, we always have the ability to end it at any time we choose.
Well, the elephant in the room is the state mandate for masks versus our mandate for masks, and whether to continue include that in this public health order number 3, or we allow the governor's order to rule the day, or whatever you want to say, to be the governing order. So, and again, that I'm totally supportive of the resolution. I would and defer to the governor's order on the mask thing, just to take the pressure off, as we, it's with governor picked that up and decided to do that. So, and again, I guess we figure out in a month, 2 months or whatever, that we can figure out, if his order is going to expire in a month, we can figure out where we're at and put back in. I realize it's also bad and hard to put back on the mask message as well as the order and the rest. So that's the elephant in the room. That's my comment.
Well, I'd love to hear public health's recommendation on whether they think there's value to extending this, considering that I think most of the elements in here have become somewhat duplicative with state requirements. I mean, not just the masks, but given the guidelines that the state is requiring. I think in general, I feel inclined to keep this as is. I think a few things. One, unless we intend to communicate to the public that something has changed, we shouldn't change anything. I think there's enough confusion out there already without adding to it. And I think when you change something, it signals to people that something has changed, even if really in practicality, nothing has changed about the requirements. And then I do see a lot of value in continuing to have this partnership with businesses where they are putting together a plan for how they're going to prevent disease spread within their business. And I feel like it's working. And so to that extent, I don't see a lot of need to make a change here. With regards to, I would just respond to Commissioner Monger's point about the masks. I feel like we've already taken this heat. I don't think anything is going to change politically as a result of making changes to this order. And I also think that we have found that our constituents tend not to know who made the rules, and they're not going to particularly care that we, who made the rules, I guess. People continue to, I heard this yesterday on our policy call, you know, people continue to send emails to the city about their restrictive public health rules. You know, people continue to say that we've been closing businesses when in reality, the only businesses Route County ever closed were lodging establishments. I think people don't know where the rules come from. So I don't, even if I were inclined to try to gain something politically from this, which I'm not, I don't think we would gain it, quite frankly. So I would really like to hear what public health's thoughts are about the value of this. Again, considering that a lot of it probably is at this point covered by state orders, but just curious whether from a public health and an education standpoint, they see continued value in this order. That would be the other consideration I'd like to make.
Right. I mean, I do know that leading up to the state's order, local entities did refer to this public health order in enforcing mask wearing, for example, in their businesses. And so to the degree that the state order supplants that, that probably takes away a little bit of that benefit for it. The business mitigation plan concept, I think, has been an important one. I think it's very important for businesses to be deliberate in what they're doing in disease prevention in their business. So I'm glad that we had that to stimulate people's forethought on how they were going to operate stuff. The mask requirement that we have in there just says businesses face mask covering. I know we have, and we can talk about that too with the face mask ordinance too, but we've had some questions in the community about how our local face mask ordinance references mesh with the state references. And I don't know if we feel the need to clarify that or if we feel that this is self-evident that they're not in conflict and, you know. And maybe that's something for Linnea could even comment on. Do we have any conflicts there between our different ordinances with regards to the mask order that came out from the state this week?
I would not use the term conflict. The difference is that our mask requirement makes no reference to age. The state's order does not require masks for people 10 and under.
So the big question here is, how would this affect our local school districts?
It applies to our local school districts.
So I guess that would be a question I'd like to see resolved. I'm certainly of the mind to defer to our local school districts to the extent that we can in how they determine how to move forward with opening schools and however they're looking at doing that. And I wouldn't want our local public health order to put constraints on a direction that the local school districts chose to take on their own.
Well, the school districts are going to have to follow either our rule or the state rules. That's simple as that. So
no, but I'm just envisioning a school district determining that they, for instance, did not want to have required masks in the elementary schools. And then at that point, our local public health order would create a problem for them.
Less than 10, yes.
I think we should be careful because I think that the schools are going to be a really tricky thing to navigate in terms of controlling disease spread. And while I hear what you're saying, we don't want to put constraints on them. I do think we should defer to the public health argument about whether there should be a requirement for children under the age of 10 or not. Because that's, I mean, the state rule is for 10. The guidance that the state put out the other day did indicate, well, it was a little fuzzy, but there was a recommendation for masks, right? I know at least Steamboat Springs has indicated that kids will be wearing masks. And while I understand what you're saying, Tim, I do think that there's also value in us doing what our staff believes is in the interest of public health, because I think we also put school districts in a tough situation if they have to decide, you know.
It's all who wants to be under the bus, right?
Right. And I totally get it, but they are not the ones who really are in the position to make decisions about public health, right? They're in the position to make decisions about kids' education. And I do think I won't speak for all of them. I know they have different constraints, but I do think it puts them in a tough situation if they have to make the call about who should and shouldn't be wearing masks.
So perhaps in this week that we have between now and the time we have to decide about the extension of this public health order, we could reach out to the school districts and have a conversation with them. And I don't disagree with what you're saying, Commissioner Melton, that ultimately it's a public health decision that needs to be made and probably ideally would not be influenced by other considerations. But nonetheless, I guess I'd like to, it would be nice if we arrived at a place where our best judgment about public health coincided with the school district's best decision on how to reopen.
Yeah, I think, you know, there are reasons that Colorado is not the only state that put a lower age limit on requirements for masks. And I think there is some evidence regarding disease prevalence and especially spread that should be considered. I guess I would still defer to our public health folks to give us some recommendations. And I think in the end, we can make the decision we're going to make about it. But I guess my request would be maybe that when we consider, well, our attorneys are going to want amendments prior to next Wednesday when we vote on this. But I do think what you're saying is important, which is the most obvious impact of our rule being requiring masks for kids under 10 is going to be what happens when schools reopen and what the requirements are. And so we should consider that.
And the other argument would be, and that again, we need to hear from our local public health officials, but presumably at the state level, there are epidemiological evidence to support the 10-year-old time frame. So the question would be, what's different about here in Rouse County on that particular issue?
But I'd be careful with that. I mean, I know Dr. Harrington should speak. I'd be careful about that because there's been this kind of, well, didn't the state have a reason for not requiring face masks? Well, yeah, they had a lot of reasons, but we don't agree with those reasons.
Believe me, I thought about that as the words were coming out of my mouth. So
there are other
reasons. For me to shut up and listen to what Dr. Harrington might have to say about this subject.
I think it's just worth noting there are political considerations as well, and we recognize that, and we have to make the decisions that we think are best locally.
Yeah, I would just comment. I'm comfortable with the 10-year age limit as having been somewhat thought out at the state level, but I myself am not intimately familiar with all the data that's either pro or con for it. Maybe that's something I'll dive into a bit better. But I do understand the idea being that the prevalence of disease in that age group is very low. The evidence of transmission in that age group is not proven to be very high. I'm just stepping back though, you know, the schools relate to our community and our community relates to the schools. If we had a high prevalence of disease in our community, we might be looking at doing all measures possible, even if they seem to have a marginal benefit to reducing the spread within the community. But I can look into this a bit more too and make my own decision on it. I to this point had been a little bit undecided on which way to go in terms of the age limit for mask wearing. But I think we need to clarify that because we've had questions during the past week and people are aware that there is a difference between our local public health approach to it and what the state now is suggesting.
Well, I think the clarification is right now, there is no lower age limit in our public health order, period. Right. So that's that, if, for people who have that question, that's the clarification at this point in time.
I mean, the CDC and others have for some time said that nobody under age two needs to worry about a mask and it's not practical for them to wear one anyway. But
Well, and I don't think we've ever said that people should not follow that CDC guideline, even though the order says what it says. I guess, Tim, my suggestion to us would be maybe that we request that Dr. Harrington recommend the language that he's comfortable with for that public health order, and then we would be prepared to vote on that next week.
So again, you know, the can talk about the confusion and the rest. The governor has now issued a mask order and the rest. And so I guess we all believed in the masks and the rest and moving forward. So now we have two mask orders and to figure out which ones, I guess they're basically the same other than the age groups from what I understand, from what I think. So again, I'm not, and again, I'm an anti-regulatory kind of guy anyhow and the rest. So we're going to have a conversation with Scott on the next part of this conversation as well. So, you know, I think the masks were very beneficial and I think, but at the same point in time, I don't know, maybe they've been beneficial. So we don't know.
Yes, they have.
So I'm inclined to accept Commissioner Melton's recommendation that Dr. Harrington prepare the language that he think best suits the community and bring that forward for our consideration a week from today.
Can I make a recommendation, please? This is Eric, and please allow Dr. Harrington and legal staff to work together. As you know, the public health orders are in legal language, and I wouldn't ask the good doctor to have to do that. If he can just do his research on his end and let me know when he's ready to discuss that, he and I will work together. We have in the past, and we'll work together to get some language before you.
Eric, I'm good with letters, too.
You know what, having said that though, that's good advice, Eric, because I sure don't want you performing any medical procedures on me, so.
I was not implying that Dr. Harrington's not capable of doing it. I just think he's busy enough on his end that we should pick up the rest.
I would love to have your help on it, Eric. We'll trade a couple jokes.
Got you.
Please, in private, that would be great.
Yeah.
Okay, is there any more discussion on this subject, or are we ready to move forward to our enforcement guidelines? I think everybody's ready to move forward. Scott, I think this is you.
Thank you. Before I start, first of all, I guess I need to share my screen. And I'm assuming that everyone can see that okay.
Yep, looks good.
And then
a
also
a beautiful picture of the coronavirus, by the way, Scott. So really pretty.
Thank you. So always a good way to start a presentation with a pretty picture. And before I start on this, Robin had asked me to say something about the executive order that came out today about 10 p.m. liquor sales. Some information went out yesterday that wasn't correct. It was based on, what we'd seen previously with these public orders and how our variants would supersede what was in those executive orders. And there was specific language that said that. There's no specific language in this executive order. And I've confirmed, and Commissioner Melton has confirmed, that the 10 p.m. liquor sales will apply and not supersede the variant. So I just want to make that clear to everybody that that's the case, and apologize for the confusion on that. So are there any questions or anything else about that? Okay.
I do. Scott, to clarify the clarification, time frame, the restriction is applied statewide. I think you said that it does not supersede the variance. So that's confusing. The 10 o'clock restriction applies statewide. That's really the bottom line.
Thanks, Eric. And yeah, we've already started receiving comments back on that one. So we'll see where all that goes. So continuing
on. That reinforces my earlier statement that no one is clear on where the rules come from, and we shouldn't assume that people are. This is not our rule. This is the governor's rule.
Yep, thanks for that. Okay, moving on to the next slide, talking about enforcement guidelines. I was tasked with coming up with more formal enforcement guidelines to help meet our requirements for an application to protect our neighbor. And you'll just see on the first slide that we have been working on monitoring, education, and support to the extent that we can with the resources that we have. I think that we do need more resources to do a better job with doing that. But we have been doing that. Presently, just my staff is going out and performing restaurant inspections and also checking in on public health orders. We have had some help internally from planning, a little bit from Mo, a little bit from building department to help check in on businesses that are not retail food establishments. To date, we've visited 108 establishments and have an 87% compliance rate. And that's with the caveat that 50% of those establishments that have been visited have been restaurants or retail food establishments, and all of those inspections were done by appointment. So really, we're here to talk about enforcement. There hasn't really been a formal process in place, and so that's what we're here to discuss. So priorities for maintaining public health all goes back to reducing transmission and also protecting vulnerable populations. So the monitoring and enforcement that we're looking for is aimed towards that. And so we're talking about wearing masks, maintaining distancing guidelines, making sure that businesses are interacting with customers in a safe manner, making sure events occur with the self-certification and not exceeding gathering limits. And we've more recently been talking about travel and community spread. And please stop me if there's any questions or anything else you want to talk about on any of these slides. Goals. We want to have consistency and interpretation of public health orders. And I guess I hesitate to say that. We've been told repeatedly and have learned hard lessons about not interpreting those public health orders, but rather we want to make sure that we have a consistent message and an accurate message. So that's still a work in progress. I also want to emphasize that education and support is an important component of enforcement, and that's really our goal. I think that, you know, above 90%, 95% of business establishments want to comply with the public health orders. And it just might be that they don't understand all the requirements. And so by getting out into the community and talking to them, making them aware of the resources that we have, our website, that we help in that respect. We also want to motivate or incentivize voluntary compliance. The goal here isn't to get anybody into trouble or to have legal issues. The goal is to get people into compliance, so we're reducing the risk of transmission. We also want to solve the logistical challenges with compliance, My staff goes out during the day. There's not a lot of monitoring being done at night or on weekends. And we don't have a lot of resources to fulfill those gaps at the moment, but we're working on that, and it seems like help is on the way. We've already done this, established a central location for tracking inquiries, complaints, and I'll talk a little bit more about this during statistics, when we talk about statistics. But it seems like we could do a better job tracking information, knowing how many complaints we're getting, where the complaints are coming from, and that will really help us with targeting monitoring and education efforts. We do want to mobilize public health educators and monitors, and you know, we'd do a much better job if we had a few more people that we could rely on to do that, and you know, be a bigger presence in the community, try to be a positive presence in the community. The work that we've done to date has been very well received. And then finally, progress towards protect our neighbors, and that'll lead to restoration of economic health. So any questions? So when we talk about enforcement, I think that the way to approach it, and other counties have approached it in the same way, is really an incremental approach. And we start with spot checks and education and support and surveillance. And I think that we, you know, knock out most of any issues that we have not following public health orders by doing just that. There have been a couple cases where we've had to issue some letters after repeated complaints. And so that would be the next step. And we'll switch over to the enforcement guidelines, and we can talk about that in a little bit more detail. And then we go down towards administrative remedies, civil injunctions, and criminal actions. So we'll talk about those more specifically here. Like I said, spot checks have been going well, have been very well received. I think it really helps develop positive relationships in the community, prioritizes individual responsibility. And like I said before, most people are trying really hard and doing a great job with being in compliance with these public health orders. But because of the resources that we have to do this, and you do have some people who struggle a little bit with the public health orders, we probably have a lower level of compliance just staying with this mechanism of enforcement, just spot checks, education, and support. The next step is issuing warning letters, and this could be a warning letter, it could be a notice of violation, it's kind of the same thing. I'd rather approach it as just sending out a warning letter. And it's just the next step. It's a formal notice that's documented and hopefully creates the right dialogue with the business establishment to get them in compliance. And so far, I think that we've been pretty successful with the letters we've written and the response that we got from those business establishments. The next level are administrative actions. It does say revoking licenses. I think a better word is suspending licenses. And we know that this is a tool that we have that we can use in particular with retail food establishments that have a food license. It's more heavy-handed, obviously. It's not something that we want to do, but it would only be done if we continue to not have compliance, and then we've also collected evidence that that's the case. The next two are civil injunctive action and criminal action. And I've asked Eric to weigh in on these. He has much better expertise. So go ahead, Eric.
And there's downsides to both civil injunction actions and criminal enforcement. And I've been in discussion with the district attorney's office as well as law enforcement entities, and we've agreed that the injunction methodology works best for businesses, whereas criminal enforcement issuing citations works best for individuals. There's a lot of reasons for that, and I don't need to get into them. But obviously, both of these involve the courts, and so getting relief could be prolonged in order to do that. But hopefully, by getting someone served either with a citation or a civil process, that would send the message that whatever they're doing needs to stop. The civil injunction would include immediate and temporary, what I'll call a restraining order, a protective order, to get a business into immediate compliance, but we still have to follow civil process and get those papers served, get it served to the correct people and whatnot. Last resort, all of this, and obviously the criminal action is really the ultimate last resort, but I don't really have a good methodology in place for serving individuals with civil actions. Again, I think that's best reserved for businesses where we can find these individuals. Do you have any questions about those two steps? I think we've all discussed these ad nauseum from the beginning of this whole pandemic.
I have just one clarifying question. I've heard a lot of reference in other places to cease and desist orders. Which one of these does that align with?
It could be. People use them synonymously with notices of violation, most typically. So earlier on, Scott talked about warning letters. We could use a cease and desist notice at that point. It's just terminology. Cease and desist seems a little heavy-handed, to use Scott's terminology, but that's where that would take place.
Okay, it's just something I had heard people refer to. Was just curious where it landed in this whole thing. Thank you.
All right, thanks, Eric. Moving on to enforcement steps, I'm gonna switch my screen over. So you should see the guidelines for enforcement of public health orders. Is that what you're seeing now? Somebody give me a nod, yep, okay,
yes. Thanks.
So really this just details all of those steps. And I'll admit that I took most of this from Eagle County and then tried to fit it to our uses. And so I don't think that we need to go through this in detail, but it does, you know, start with initial public concern or complaint, responding to those complaints. Letting business establishments know and then starting that dialogue. It seems like 8 or 9 times out of 10, you know, they're very happy to hear that was the problem and that the correction is made very quickly. And it might just be, you know, a lack of understanding or maybe getting a little complacent in some areas. So most of the time that is enough, is just making contact with the business establishment, letting them know, and things get corrected from there. We do go towards the first and second warning letters or notice of violation, and you can see all the way down to that criminal action. So are there any questions about this draft document or any changes or updates that I should make? We could, I don't know if we want to do that here or you want to write an email or make suggestions or anything. So any questions about this draft document?
I think the document is good. I think my overarching question is just discussions with law enforcement. Obviously, we don't have any authority to tell them what to do, but I also believe that their participation would be beneficial to our community. I mean, we're not trying to create a police state, but they, you know, they have certain skills and training that would be supportive in some of these things. And I guess I'm curious whether conversations have been had and do we have support from law enforcement in our various jurisdictions for this effort, or would that be a next step, is getting their input as well?
So I'm really glad you brought that up. I have had conversations with local police department, and it seems that they are willing to at least fulfill surveillance and evidence collection, which is super helpful. You know, we don't want to ask law enforcement to educate the public about public health orders. We do want to fill gaps for being a presence after hours and on weekends. And there may be a little bit more that could be done. You know, a plainclothes officer or a uniformed officer. And, you know, I think just being a presence in the community, knowing that they're out there and that we're watching, I think that that's all a big help. So I need to have some further conversations, but conversations to date have been positive. And so we'll continue to work on that and make sure that that's nailed down. But I'm encouraged by the conversations that I've had so far. So
I guess the commissioners haven't had the conversation about the how far we want to take this and what we're doing here. You know, we have 87% compliance now based on what Scott said, you know, and again, those are scheduled arrivals and the rest. They know we're coming, so whatever. I mean, how do we know we get there? So, and again, I'm just, you know, that last little increment of compliance, you know, costs a lot. And I'm just trying to figure out how and when we know we get there and how far we drive this thing. So, and then
well, I think
situation with the law enforcement, yeah, it was like, well, yeah, we got 217 now, so we have to record ethnicity and the rest. And when we're out checking people for COVID compliance. So, you know, I'm just struggling here, you know, and how we figure this out and, you know, how much is enough, you know, and how much do we protect people and how far do we take that? So anyhow, just broader conversation.
I think part of the answer is doing a better job with collecting statistics. And knowing, you know, how many complaints we're getting and when and what those complaints are about. Also, you know, with our spot checks, I think that, you know, as the accumulated issues that we're having go down, I think that that's the indicator. But we got to do a better job of collecting that information. That takes time and resources to do that. But I think that more effort towards that data collection will help and help inform that.
Yeah, Doug, I guess my take on it is that this makes sense to the extent that, especially how it relates to the Protect Our Neighbors framework, this seems to be integral to that process. And I don't think that creating this framework commits anybody to any particular level of enforcement. Rather, if things get really bad, or if we have businesses that are flagrantly violating our regulations, that at least we've talked in advance about what we might do in that event. So that's the value I see on this.
I don't think this necessarily changes anything about the philosophy. You know, we're focused on education. First and foremost, our goal is compliance, not to try to, in order to protect public health. I think we're being asked to kind of provide some feedback and potentially endorsement of what the process would be. And that provides a couple of things. I think there have been questions from some community members about, well, what's being done? And I think having something in writing about here's our process, here's what we do, here's how we do it. I think this pretty clearly lays out a lot of opportunities for compliance before there would ever be any kind of enforcement action. And to date, it sounds like the warning letters have been sufficient for achieving what's needed as we get into this. The other thing, I guess I would maybe just ask if Brian's still here hiding behind his his camera. I'm not sure, but on the policy call yesterday, he made, hi, Dr. Harrington. He made some comments about just disease prevalence and, you know, what are we doing? And kind of, we have some options, and one of the best options we have is to just make sure we're doing a really good job of the measures we have in place already. And that's also where I see this. So I don't know, Dr. Harrington, if you would, you said it much better than yesterday than I just did, but.
Well, yeah, I think a couple concepts. One is that it's that phrase of, you know, if you expect to have a different result, what are you gonna do different to get a different result? And then the Protect Our Neighbor framework in particular sets out some ideas of when you don't have the prevalence level that you desire, what are you doing to achieve that better level? And I see two general approaches to that. We do new things, or we do better with what we're doing. And the new things would probably entail shutting down or restricting or increasing restrictions again, which I don't think we wish to do. So that leaves us with then the other result is to do better with the tools that we already have in place. And I'm, you know, I'm sure we do have grounds for improvement, all that. And that's where the education and support and all that can play into it.
So Beth, the other thing is that looking back at your planning activity number one in your draft, looks like Scott's helped you get a pretty good start on planning activity number one.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think we've demonstrated, and the way I articulated that in the narrative section of that is that we believe we are achieving a solid level of compliance. You know, when we're above 80%, that's good, I think. And that's what we need. And so really it's, what do we have in place to make sure that we're able to maintain that? I don't think Scott is proposing some huge increase in our enforcement actions or anything like that. It's just having a clear, concrete plan for how we make sure that we maintain that high level, which is how we keep businesses open. It's how we protect public health. So Doug, I know you're inclined to be concerned about enforcement action and that kind of thing. And I don't disagree with you. I don't think that's the direction we want to head. But I do see a huge value both in a transparency and public information standpoint and from a public health standpoint of having a clearly defined escalation process for those hopefully rare cases where it's needed.
So I would say, continue to say that, you know, the flagrant offenders, yeah, we need to deal with them. You know, we need to figure out a process to deal with that. At the same point in time, we are not a community of the whole. That all of this, we don't, the one size doesn't fit all. And again, I guess I have a few of my constituents in Hayden feel harassed as well. Maybe not so much now since the governor just placed his order in that, you know, that we could go to Craig. So, you know, whatever. So I try to figure out, you know, and I'm, agree with you, Beth, that, you know, 87% compliance. I mean, that's a hell of a number for something that's, you know, that's a hell of a good number. So I just try to figure out how, you know, the regulatory thing just concerns me. And, you know, and I, again, you know, and it's the process. And I've been through enough of those processes with the regulatory thing and then due process and how that all works out as well, too. I mean, so, yeah, I don't want to promise more that I can't deliver. So I just want to make sure that we're, and again, I'm trying to figure out what is that number that we want to get to? Is it one, is it 90% compliance or is it, you know, and again, so we're not going to ever get to 100% compliance. We know that. So I just trying to figure out some goals and objectives and we know when we're getting there and we're providing the right level of resources to do the things that we agreed that we needed to do. So anyhow, I'm just, broader perspective.
So I would say two things. And one is keep in mind that, you know, 50% of the establishments that we visited have been retail food establishments and they were made, you know, on appointment. And so, you know, they know we're coming. And so you would hope that knowing that we're coming, that they would have all those measures in place. So I expect that maybe our overall level is somewhat less than 87. The other thing I would say is there's a big benefit to being present in the community and like I said, you know, it's been very well received. The idea is that we go out, we visit these establishments, we're asking them how they're doing, if they understand the public health orders, if they need any assistance. We ask them how the business is doing. We're taking feedback back from them. And so I think that that component is extremely important as well in this effort.
I want to also, I know that, you know, masks have been the sort of political flashpoint of all this, but in reality, from a compliance and a standpoint, they're important, but this isn't about being the mask police. And when people, you know, say that they feel harassed or whatever else, that's, you know, there are a lot of other things that are also important. You know, it's those social distancing rules. It's making sure that places aren't allowing their establishments to get crowded, that in a retail food establishment that they're seating people far enough apart, that they're not going over their capacity, that they're collecting the information that we would need for contact tracing. I mean, all of these things are really critical. And I know there's an inclination to think this is about being mask police, but it really isn't. It's really about all of these things that are so critical to protecting public health during these times and making sure that those things are happening. And one could argue, obviously, while a high percentage of people wearing masks is important, you know, some of these other things are arguably more important for us to make sure they're being maintained and followed. And I know La Plata County put together some things that I keep saying this, Scott, but so I apologize for beating a dead horse on it. But, you know, they really had a list of like, what's the priority in terms of enforcement? And I thought it was really good. You know, we're going to focus on the things that have the most and most biggest and most important impact. And number one was like, if a business isn't supposed to be open, we want to make sure they're not open. Right. And it was like, if they have a capacity limit, we want to make sure they're following those capacity limits. We want to make sure they're not letting people get too close together. You know, and masks was on that list, but it wasn't the only thing. So I want to just make sure that I think we all would agree with that, that, you know, this isn't just about people walking around making sure everyone has a mask on. It really is about making sure that we are having consistent implementation of all those rules that we know are in place to prevent disease spread.
Okay. Do you have more to this presentation you want to finish up with, Scott?
Yes, thanks. So one of the things that I was asked to do is to try to nail down what are our needs and what do we want to achieve? And I started thinking about it, you know, do we want to visit 50% of all business establishments in the community once per month? And if we wanted to do that, what are the resources that we need? And I'm not sure that there's a lot of value in that. It seems like, and I could be wrong and it's certainly open for discussion, but I think maybe a better approach is to back into it a little bit. What are the resources we have? What is being fulfilled? How many establishments are we visiting? What's our compliance rate? And let that dictate whether we need more resources or less resources. Trying to come up with a hard and fast number, we want to do 50% in a month. That's one way to do it, but I guess I was a little bit more comfortable with the other approach. But certainly open to feedback on that. And it kind of rolls into this last slide where I, you know, put in what I think is the ideal setup to do this. I do have two monitors. You know, maybe we start with one monitor and see where things stand. We're getting some support, I think, from the city with volunteers. Can we fulfill our objectives using the volunteers and continuing what we're doing with my staff? I have the public health educator in there. I think that that would be a big help. I know that that's still in discussion. We have law enforcement. We talked about that with the surveillance and evidence and being a presence. So this is kind of the model that I see working. I could also see just having one monitor, but open for discussion on that.
Are these monitors that you're referring to, are they, do you believe that those roles can be fulfilled on a volunteer basis, or are you suggesting that that these become county employees?
Well, there's a lot of different ways that it could be done. We've talked about getting support from community service officers. We've talked about volunteers. We've had some support from county employees internally. You know, there's a lot of different ways to do it. And, you know, hiring, you know, a temporary or a term position for a monitor that's a county employee is definitely one way. And then you would have someone who's dedicated to performing that function. Volunteers, you know, it's kind of unknown, you know, how much help are you going to get? How long can you expect them to continue to volunteer? You know, when we're looking at using people internally, it's, you know, how does that fit in within their priorities and work schedule? So I think it would be helpful to have somebody, you know, but knowing what that entails, you know, it's a big decision. So
I was a little confused, Scott, about what you were saying in terms of, you know, what the objective would be and what resources we have available. I mean, I sort of followed what you said, but I didn't really get the conclusion there. So given the resources we have now available to us, what level of this activity do you think is possible, and kind of what's the difference between that and what you think is needed, or are do you think we're able to achieve what we believe is, I guess I just, you know, I'll do my dog impression of, you know, what's the objective here? What are we trying to achieve? Because I think more is not really an objective to me. And 100% is certainly not the goal. And so kind of, you know, what would you propose we try to achieve with this program?
So I think that staying above 80% compliance rate is a good objective. But I don't think that we have adequate data that really tells us whether or not we're truly achieving that number. And so I think that at least some more short-term efforts in data collection to try to flesh that out a little bit more and feel more comfortable with the fact that we're staying above 80%. And then I also think that we need to be tracking, you know, our complaints and inquiries. And so, you know, I don't know what that, you know, what a good objective would be, because, you know, those complaints kind of come in, you know, when there's new public health orders or changes. You know, I expect to get a lot of feedback based on the 10 p.m. Alcohol sales rule. So, you know, I think that achieving 80% and having enough data to feel comfortable with that number, and then also tracking some of our other statistics. And so, as far as an objective goes with complaints, you know, I'm not sure what that looks like.
So I, just to follow up, thank you. That's helpful. I guess my inclination would be, well, first of all, I would say one thing. We keep using the term volunteer to refer to city and county staff who are being paid for their time to do this. So I want to just clarify to make sure that's actually what we're talking about, because that's not what I would think of as a volunteer. I mean, we're not trying to like recruit people off the street to do this, right? We're using people who are on the clock, who are being reassigned from their regular duties to support this work. Is that what we're talking about?
So, you know, Mark might need to clarify. Certainly the employees, the county employees that we've been using are on the clock. I guess my understanding was with city employees that they would truly be a volunteer, but I guess I'm not sure. So maybe Mark can chime in on that.
I have a meeting today with Gary Suter with the city, and I can get that clarification, Beth, because quite frankly, it was not fleshed out when the names were provided to us. So I know some of those individuals from the city said, I'm available on Saturdays. And I don't know if their intent was, hey, that's a day that I'm not normally working, and that is a day I could volunteer. So I'll get that clarification from the city of Steamboat. If we were visiting about Rout County employees, I think, as has been our protocol up to this point, it is essentially a reassignment of what are their regular duties. So they would still be quote unquote on the clock, but they would simply be reassigned to this function.
So I guess I don't know what input Scott's looking for specifically, but I guess I would just say, I think, you know, this scheme makes sense, and it makes sense to me what Scott's saying, that all that's really needed at this point is for us to identify some resources that can increase some of that data collection and monitoring effort. It sounds like we should at least start with this support from city staff and see if that's adequate. And then I guess a follow-up question, I thought that, Scott, you said only your department is doing this right now. I guess I understood previously that we had some planning and building department staff that was also supporting and would be kind of in that monitor role. I guess, could you clarify, or do we not have any other county staff supporting this anymore?
So we don't have any other staff supporting at this point. We did get some help from planning and from the building department. And, you know, they sort of fulfilled the request. It was difficult and took a lot of time to make that happen. I would love to have some more support, and, you know, I need Mark's help to, you know, really redirect priorities. And so they kind of fulfilled what we asked, and we haven't gone any further to making more requests of staff. And then, you know, also we've been talking a long time about, you know, other public health support staff that was coming on. And so I think kind of waiting to see what the outcome of that was, but certainly we could go and make that request again and see if, you know, we had people from building or planning department in particular that might be willing to perform that function some more.
So just what my last request would be personally, and obviously Tim and Doug get a say too, I think we need a number of hours per week that we believe are needed in order to determine whether we're filling that or not. That would be my two cents.
And Beth, commissioners, I just want to make a clarification that the building department got right into the midst of their busiest time of the year, and we had no expectation that they were going to provide any more support. And as it turns out, and I think you know from some recent reports from Todd, they have really ramped up. So there's not been that resource available, and we knew that going in. So let me provide that clarification. Number two, indeed, we did get some help from the planning department, and that was regionalized in terms of other areas of the county. Those efforts, and it's my understanding, were still ongoing. I can double check on that, but those are resources that I just wanted to make those two clarifications.
Yeah, I guess my comment would be, or is more of a question, but as we prioritize the things that we are doing to support public health, this monitor question, the question of whether or not to be hiring monitors, where does that stack up against hiring contact tracers, health educators, et cetera, et cetera? So, and I'm not sure I've formed an opinion on that myself. I mean, you could always make the case that an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure, but that may not necessarily translate to this situation.
So I guess I would defer to Carrie or Dr. Harrington on that one.
I don't have a comment on it. I think Dr. Harrington had to step away.
I think I heard you say you don't have a comment. Or you do have a comment, Carrie.
No, I don't have a comment at this time on the prioritization of this.
Okay, thank you.
Well, I guess I just have a couple comments here, and Scott, you did a great job putting this together. And again, I really appreciate the education concept of it all. You know, we don't need to be the police, whatever you want to call it, or whatever we're from the Gestapo, whatever. So I just want to make sure that we're out there doing, you know, and again, we're investing in our recovery. I keep talking about that, and it's investing, everybody's investing in all of our recovery. So I support that. I really struggle hard with the complaint driven system. And you know, hey, you know, my steak was bad at night, you know, and the cocktail wasn't quite good, you know, and I didn't like the person in first place. And so I really want to make sure that, you know, complaint driven scenarios are not good. So that's why I appreciate the concept of, you know, it's a friendly arrival, and we're telling you how you can invest in our recovery when you go visit these places as well. And so, you know, I just think, I guess this is part of this discussion and the missing link that we were having with this health education too. And maybe finding out what that actually might have done and what we were looking to do. So that for further discussion. So I don't have a problem with what we're doing. And again, I just, like I said, I'm an anti-regulatory kind of concept, and I like people to do the right thing in the first place. And we know that people, you're going to have 10% of them that are not going to do the right thing with the rules, and no matter what you do. So anyhow, appreciate the presentation, Scott.
So the operative question right now, Scott, it sounded like you wanted to make a priority of the monitoring and collection of data and statistics. So do you believe you have the resources available to you now to be able to complete that first part of the task?
I would say no, that we need some additional support.
Okay.
I guess the follow-up to that, though, is that as a starting point, are these city staff members and understanding how much support they're going to be able to provide? Scott, would you agree that maybe that's at least a starting point?
I do think it's a starting point. I think it's with the monitoring and perhaps that public health educator with that position. Some of that work would be fulfilled. And then, you know, with this complaints, I think really with the complaints, what we're doing is we're monitoring trends. We can't move forward with any enforcement process unless there's evidence. And so really it's just a tool to try to help monitor the level of compliance. What are the numbers of complaints, and what type of complaints, and how many of them do we get?
So, commissioners, I know we're not going to be making any decisions today, certainly on staffing levels or anything like that, but perhaps we could task Mark with absorbing this information and then coming back and talking to us about a path forward to provide the resources that we think we need. Does that sound like a good direction?
Yeah, that sounds like a great direction. So yeah, I'd like to plan.
Yeah, I would agree. I think, Scott, we can express our support for Scott's concept here. And then it sounds like, you know, obviously some things have already been identified in terms of resources, and we need to determine whether those are adequate and what gaps still exist. The other thing I heard you say, Scott, is that you wanted to develop more of a process for monitoring complaints. Is that something you're planning on taking on, or is that something where you're looking for some support from someone else?
I'm looking for some support, for sure. It's been tough to keep up with all of that. And, you know, you gotta track it and, you know, set up a spreadsheet or something. And so it's been difficult to keep up with all of that stuff. And I'm just trying to keep up with the monitoring that we're doing. And that's, you know, that's been a challenge at times. And so,
question. All I'm really trying to pose is just making sure that something happens as a result of that conversation. So I don't know, Tim, what the right way to give direction on that is, but I mean, I'm supportive of us figuring out how to put systems in place that, rather than kind of this scattershot that we have right now, and maybe just helping Scott figure out who might have the time to be able to do that. And I don't think we need to necessarily do that, but I would just express my support.
Yeah, I agree. I think Scott's done a good job of getting our minds around what the objectives are. And I think that I'm sensing that as commissioners, we believe that these are important things to do. And the question is how do we get them done? And I think that's the role for the county manager to come back with some options on how we can achieve those objectives.
I guess the other question I have is, what do we need to do to formalize this process?
I think we just did.
What process are you talking about, Scott?
Well, the enforcement guidelines. These are our Rapp County enforcement guidelines. This isn't a draft document anymore. This is the system that we're following.
Yeah, I think so. Unless there's anything needed on the legal end of things, I think that we have said, yes, these are the guidelines we're following.
Okay.
I
didn't know if there was something more that we needed to do, but that's good enough for me, for sure.
I agree.
Great.
Okay. We are running a bit over, and then we still wanted to reserve some time for public comment. So if you guys are willing, let's move forward to public comment. So I would ask Kendra to describe to the public our public comment process.
Yeah, so the way public comment works is you'll raise your hand and then we'll call on you in the order that the hands are raised. So if you're on your computer, you'll go down to the bottom, click the raise your hand function. If you're calling in on the phone, you would press *9 to raise your hand. So if you guys all want to go ahead, raise your hand now if you'd like to make public comment.
I am seeing one hand raised. That would be Ray DuBois. So Ray, you're here to make public comment today?
No, not a comment, but a question. Since Carrie's here, and this is something that I asked her a couple months ago, and I just wanted, and it's not something that I've discussed with the commissioners, but it's been in my monthly update. It has to do with the request for porta pots being placed in the county right of way on county roads for bicyclists. I know when I talked to Carrie about it before, you know, if we could do a daily cleaning of those, it's less of an issue. But these porta johns will only be cleaned once a week if they're put out. So. And these are put out by the Rapp County Riders. There's 7 locations, and I've been discouraging it for weeks and weeks and weeks, and it came back to me one last time here, in my opinion, one last time. And so even though there's hand sanitizer, you know, in the porta pots, and they're plastic, and I really can't even tell you how often they're being used per day or per week. None of us can. But I personally don't feel comfortable with it, especially with increased cases and stuff. And so I just wanted to get like a last final opinion on this.
I'll give you my opinion on it yet again. No, no way, no how. That's just not enough cleaning of those to be safe for the community, right? It's an opportunity for there to be some sort of a cleaning service to come in more frequently, certainly.
But if they looked into that, and the company just can't do it since they're spread around, and that's been my whole thing. If it's once a week, in my opinion, that wasn't enough.
No,
but
sir.
I know we got an avid bicyclist there.
So there's an obvious public health trade-off here if those porta potties don't exist.
Yeah, we know what they do.
So, well, great. You've got your opinion, Ray.
Okay. That's all I need.
I see that we have another hand raised. Yvonne, if you would, for the benefit of our listeners, identify yourself, please.
Yes, this is Yvonne Trula. And I just wanted to add to the idea of having flu vaccinations as part of the COVID-19 clinic in the fall. As someone who has a child who's very medically fragile and elderly parents, the idea of going to a medical facility to get a flu vaccination is quite scary. And I could foresee people who are vulnerable having to weigh that risk. However, if it was a drive-through type situation, I think it would make those.
Yvonne, I think we lost you there. At least I did.
Okay, at what point?
just a minute ago, you were talking about availability of drive-in for flu vaccinations.
Yes, as a mother of someone who is very medically fragile and elderly parents, it can be scary, the idea of going to a medical clinic and having to weigh the risks of getting COVID-19 versus getting the flu vaccination. And therefore, if we were able to get the flu vaccination at those drive-in clinics, I think that it would help alleviate a lot of that fear, and you might have more compliance in that vulnerable population.
Great. Thank you very much for your comments.
Thank you.
I am not seeing any other raised hands, so I am going to close public comment at this time and then return to the group for any final questions, comments, or updates. Okay.
I would just like to say thank you for my time with Route County. I appreciate having been able to serve the community, and I wish nothing but the best and safety and wellness for the commissioners and for the county and for the community.
Great. Thank you, Karen. Thank you very much. Any other?
I don't have anything. Sorry, I'm trying to wolf down my lunch before my 1:30 meeting, which I'm already late for, but I have been listening intently to everything.
Great. Doug, Mark.
I'm good.
Robin. Okay, let's go ahead and adjourn the meeting. We will see you all tomorrow.
Thanks, Tim.